This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A huge gay march on Washington is planned for this Sunday. Organizers expect it to be the largest gay march ever. One issue that has galvanized homosexuals but divided the country is whether the ban on gays in the military should be lifted. My guest Randy Schultz is the author of a new history of gays and lesbians in the military called Conduct Unbecoming. Schultz is also the author of what many consider to be the definitive book about the AIDS crisis and the ban played on. Schultz writes for the San Francisco Chronicle and was the first openly gay journalist to write for a major daily newspaper. In 1981, there was a policy shift on gays in the military. Schultz says prior to that, gays were discharged for homosexual conduct. The new policy required the military to discharge people who demonstrated a propensity to engage in homosexual acts. In other words, you could get discharged for being gay or saying you were gay without having engaged in misconduct. Schultz says this policy stepped up what he describes as gay purges in the military.
The strategy became in the 1980s that rather than going after gay individuals, the purges would go after, you know, trying to get every gay person on a particular base or installation, and that's the real sad story of this whole tale of gays in the military is not that they kick people out, but the very draconian measures that they use to kick people out in executing this policy.
What are some of the methods that you came across in your research?
A very typical gay investigation will start out when a military investigative agency will get a tip that somebody's gay. And what they'll do is take this person, who very often is an extraordinarily frightened 19 or 20-year-old, they'll take them into a room, and then they'll say, well, we've got videotapes of you having sex. We know you've engaged in sodomy. We can send you to prison at Fort Leavenworth if you don't confess and if you don't name others. The naming others is the crucial component of how these purges are conducted. And since these people who they take in are very young and inexperienced, and they also tend to be patriotic, so they believe what government agents tell them, that these tactics are extremely effective. One tactic that was used in the 1980s is investigators will take a single mother into a small room and threaten her not only with prison, but say, we're going to go to child welfare authorities and have your child taken away from you if you do not first confess to being gay and then name others. And so very often these people crack. They'll give 6-7 names. Those 6 or 7 people are then taken into small rooms, subjected to the same kind of intimidation, and then they in turn give 6 or 7 more names. And so in no time, the military can get a huge list of suspected gay people.
Now, you write that the hunt for lesbians in the military in the 1980s was an obsession, more of an obsession than it was with men?
Yes, clearly. If you look statistically, about 3 times as many women on a per capita basis are kicked out for being gay in the military than men are. In the 2 services that are most resistant to having women, which is the Navy and the Marine Corps, the numbers are even higher. In the Marine Corps, if you're a woman, you're 7 times as likely to be kicked out for being gay as if you're a man. I think this stems from the fact that the military was very resistant to having women at all, and they can't kick people out for being women, but they can kick people out for being gay. And so what you saw was basically most women were assumed to be lesbians if they were in the military, unless they could prove otherwise. And the regulation became a mechanism for this pandemic sexual harassment that women face in the armed forces. It was I can't tell you how many women I talked to who had colleagues or superiors within the military put the make on them and then basically say that if they didn't go to bed with the men, that the men would accuse them of being lesbians. And if a woman went and complained about sexual harassment and the man went and accused a woman of being lesbian, invariably the command structure never investigated the sexual harassment complaint, but did aggressively investigate the accusation of homosexuality.
There was something that you call the Paris Island Purge of 1988. What happened there?
This was in of a lesbian drill instructors in Parris Island, which is the only Marine Corps base where women are trained. And this was, again, you had the women who were singled out tended to be women who were in non-traditional jobs. And in this case, there were drill instructors, which is sort of the great, the most macho of macho jobs in the Marine Corps. And what happened was it started with rumors that were being spread at different bases that there were a lot of lesbians at Parris Island. And so the Naval Investigative Service, apparently under the direction of the Marine Corps headquarters in Quantico, launched a very brutal series of interrogations. One woman was told her child would be taken away, and then she was locked in a room with her estranged husband, who had beaten her and had a history of abuse. Other women were lit. One woman in particular, a corporal named Barbara Baum, was kept on. It was believed by the Marine Corps brass that she knew the names of all kinds of lesbians. So she was court-martialed, and every step of the court-martial, she was told, "If you name names, if you give us names of other lesbians, we won't court-martial you." She refused. She ended up being court-martialed, and she was sent to prison for consensual sex in the privacy of her own bedroom off base. She was sent to prison and continued to be pressured to give names. Ultimately, she did give 77 names to military investigators, and with the promise that she would be released from prison. Of course, they did not release her from prison, and she was kept there. You had a situation, in essence, where somebody was put into prison until they named names of other gays, and that was her crime, and what she was imprisoned for was not naming the names of other lesbians. In the end, half of the women on that base were interrogated about suspected lesbians, and I think the Marine Corps lost 10% of its female drill instructors.
Randy Schultz is my guest, the author of the new book, Conduct Unbecoming Gays and Lesbians in the U.S. Military. What kind of explanation did you get from the military when you asked them about the purges of gays?
They would say, and somewhat dissembling, that all they were doing was investigating possible violations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, because the UCMJ have a provision that provides for 5 years at hard labor for anyone who is convicted of sodomy. So they would say that they were merely exercising, you know, their legal duties in enforcing this code. What was somewhat dissembling about this, when I talked to the head of investigations for the Naval Investigative Service, I said, okay, you're enforcing the sodomy provision, and this provision in the law, in Article 125 of the UCMJ, is not written, it is written for both heterosexuals and homosexuals. You cannot basically participate in any sex other than missionary, you know, position sex between members of the opposite sex. And I said, okay, when was the last time you investigated a heterosexual for sodomy? And he had been there 6 years and could not recall a single case. So these laws are selectively enforced solely against gay people.
In looking at the history of gays and lesbians in the military, did you find that the rationales for keeping gays and lesbians out of the military changed over the decades?
Yes, the rationales have suited the times. At the beginning, in the 1940s, the original gay regulations were meant to be a compassionate response to the presence of gay people in the military. You see, it used to be, before World War II, that they'd just throw anybody in prison if they found out they were gay, or if they could court-martial them for gay conduct. And then the concept with the new regulations in 1943 was that these people aren't criminals, they're sick, so we should deal with it as a medical problem. And that's when they used the medical paradigm. During the McCarthy era in the 1950s, that was saw the creation of the whole concept that gay people were a threat to national security. And that was really totally created in the McCarthy era. And then in the more recent years, when the security risk argument doesn't really hold up, and it's difficult for the military to make credible arguments that gay people aren't fit to serve, the arguments have instead become, well, heterosexuals won't want to serve with gay people. They won't take orders. They won't want to be in the same foxholes. They won't want to share the same barracks with gay people. So now we're seeing the argument that it would disrupt the good order, discipline, and morale of the military to have gay people there.
In the, the big issue now is if you said, cohesion of the troops. And one of the arguments you hear a lot is that romantic involvement has no place in war if there is a troop of men fighting in battle, and one of them is lovers with another, there will be a special relationship that will undermine the democracy of the group and the cohesion of the group. You can't favor one person more than another. You can't be more concerned about one person's welfare more than another's in that kind of battle situation. What's your response to that?
Well, I think in those kind of situations with heterosexuals and they have married couples, I do not believe that married couples among heterosexuals are put in the same unit where that could be a factor. And I would expect that once gay people were allowed to serve, that they would have to have certain rules in order to limit that kind of interference with the group as well.
I guess, of course, the difference is there haven't been men and women together on the battlefield ever in American history.
Yeah.
Whereas there have been men together, so it would be possible for men to have a secret relationship with each other on the battleground.
I think these things, it could be possible, I haven't heard that being raised as a huge issue.
I have, that's why I bring it up.
I have? Oh, yeah. I haven't heard that. No, it would just seem to me that especially I think in the near future where we're going to be seeing a lot of the lifting of the combat exclusion policies around women, and that both heterosexuals and gay soldiers are going to be facing these issues, and that it seems to me an appropriate area for the military to have regulations about.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about gays in the military. My guest is Randy Schultz, who's investigated the history of gays and lesbians in the military. His new book is called Conduct Unbecoming. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Randy Schultz is my guest. Randy, what do you think of the military's policy on AIDS and testing for HIV?
Actually, the military has done a very admirable job of dealing with the HIV epidemic. At the beginning, in the early 1980s, when the first people were coming down with AIDS in the military, the reaction was to, you know, try to kick them all out for being gay. And there's some very tragic stories of people who were not even well enough to sit up during their discharge hearings who were subjected to this kind of treatment. But once the military started testing every one of their troops in late 1985 and early 1986, first they found that a much larger number than they had predicted were testing positive, and those people testing positive, an awful lot of them were in very high-ranking, very sensitive positions. There were a lot of colonels who tested positive, a lot of people in military intelligence. And I think you had that factor added to the fact that the medical people in the medical branch of the military did not believe that it was right to be kicking people out. They always took a more compassionate approach to this, so that those factors ended up resulting in regulations in the military that provide for non-discrimination if you're HIV positive and for confidentiality of your medical records. If you are HIV positive, you are not allowed to go overseas or you're not allowed to participate in combat or be in a deployable unit. There's a rationale for that that makes sense. You know, you don't want people on the battlefield bleeding when they could, you know, if they're HIV positive. But on the whole, these regulations have been, people are allowed to stay in, and these regulations have been very well enforced.
You write that in the past decade, gays have served as generals in every branch of the armed forces. The
yes.
Marine Corps had at least one gay person in a 4-star rank since 1981.
And so did the Army.
Now, you don't mention who they are, and I'm not asking you to mention
yeah.
who they are, but I'm wondering if you've been tempted to out them and what your personal policy as a journalist investigating this issue is on that.
I don't believe in outing as a rule, except in cases where there's, egregious hypocrisy. And I feel if you're going to out somebody, you need on-the-record sources, people who will say with their names that they know as a fact that this person is gay. With one of the generals, was not engaged in this kind of hypocrisy. There was another general, one of the 4-star generals, who actually was in charge of a branch of the service that had one of the most brutal lesbian witch hunts in the 1980s. And I would have outed him had I had on-the-record sources, basically on the criteria of hypocrisy. But I didn't have those sources, and I didn't want the book discussion to be changed into a discussion of outing and whether I was right or wrong to do it. So I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't out him by name.
Right. You've been following the congressional debate, no doubt, on gays
yes.
in the military. What has struck you most about it?
I think what's struck me the most about the congressional hearings is how appallingly ignorant both the senators and the experts are about the reality of gay people in the military. That sort of watching these experts try to inform the senators is like watching the blind leading the blind, deaf, and dumb. That these experts know very little They may know about rules and regulations, but they clearly have not talked to hardly anyone who is gay in the military, so that they don't have any. So what they say is a lot of just fiction. The whole issue of how the military conducts these witch hunts and these purges has been completely neglected, and I feel in this case that even people who support the policy would be flabbergasted if they knew what the military does. And the cruel ways that they use, to enforce this policy.
Do you think that President Clinton is backing down on his promise to overturn the ban on gays in the military?
No, I think the president indicated last week when he met with gay leaders that he absolutely was going to lift the ban on gays in the military. And so then the controversy will go to Congress where they could vote to reenact the ban as part of a piece of legislation. But then they would almost need veto-proof majorities, which I think would be very difficult to obtain in both the House and the Senate.
You've said that you learned a lot about the connection between the women's movement and the gay rights movement by researching this book. What did you find out?
Well, it was very interesting because intellectually I always knew there was a linkage between the gay movement and the women's movement, but it was fascinating to watch it played out in the lives of these people. What is this military regulation really all about? It's about manhood. It's about the confusing place that we are in American society now about the roles of men and the roles of women. The military is the one institution that guaranteed to do one thing beyond all else, and that was to take boys and make them into men. And the reason the military really has not wanted women, and the reason that women have been subjected to horrible sexual harassment in the military, is basically the same reason that the military doesn't want gay people, that the presence of women, the presence of gay people in the military is a threat to those individuals who have sought out this institution in a way to reinforce their own sense of manhood. And that's what it all gets down to. It's all about masculinity and manhood and having one last bastion where the traditional old-fashioned concepts of masculinity are still enshrined.
My guest is Randy Schultz, author of the new book, Conduct Unbecoming, Gays and Lesbians in the U.S. Military. Randy, you developed AIDS while you were researching your book on the military. Having written such an important book about AIDS, I wonder if you think that all the research that you've done is affecting your perception of your own condition and what it's like for you to be going through what you've written about so much.
Well, unfortunately, I know all about this disease inside out. And I had stopped basically writing about AIDS in 1990 because it was just too stressful. I live in the gay community of San Francisco, so you have to, everybody, most gay men are HIV positive here, and so you're dealing with your friends who might be getting sick. I was dealing with it professionally, and then I was dealing with it in my own life, and so it just became too much, and I basically had to stop writing about it because it was, I was starting to get psychosomatic symptoms and things of stress.
I remember when I interviewed you in, I guess it was 1987, after And the Band Played On came out.
Yeah.
You were telling me that on some of the TV interviews, people would say, and by the way, Randy Schultz, do you test positive for HIV? And you were just appalled that,
yes,
that people would just ask you about that, in a public forum like that. As it turns out, you had tested positive at the time, and you decided to not mention it, which... a decision I'm not challenging at all. I'm just wondering what it was like for you to go through this kind of public display, being asked that all the time and not wanting to talk about it.
Well, it was weird. It's such a... I think heterosexuals don't have a lot of etiquette around that issue because it is intensely private and it's not something that you necessarily want to talk about on national TV. And I just couldn't believe when people would just, ask it like it's like asking me, if it was a nice day or something, like they had a right to know. And so it was a very strange situation. My basic answer was, at that point and up until I disclosed recently, was that the only people who really have a right to know are people I was going to bed with. And that's to some extent how I feel about it. Then I got sick and the news was going to get out anyway, and I felt it was important for me to disclose it as opposed to have other people do it for me.
Right. I'd like to ask you something about what I imagine was a really big change for you when you were young. I recently found out in reading all these recent articles that have come out about you, that you are the president and founder of your local chapter of Young Americans for Freedom, which is a very conservative group.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what you were like as a young conservative.
Well, you know, I grew up in Aurora, Illinois, which was at that time extremely conservative part of the country. They had not elected or voted for a Democrat since like in over 100 years. And so that was sort of the ideas that I was exposed to. And then also I did what a lot of, I think, people do when they're in junior high and high school, and I read a lot of Ayn Rand, which still has an impact on me in that I'm a very strong individualist. I think that influenced my thinking in a very conservative direction. And I think that's been real good. I mean, I'm not that, obviously not that conservative anymore. But I think with people on both ends of the political extreme, either the left or the right, there's a tendency to dehumanize the people with whom they disagree. And I feel real grateful that I had the opportunity to be exposed to a lot of very conservative people, because you can see that they, you know, most of them are just like people on the left, where they sincerely believe that what they're doing is right. They're not evil people. They're not malicious. They just, you know, they just have different points of view. So I think it was very helpful for me as a journalist, because it let me see the importance of being fair and being balanced in coverage.
Are you going to keep writing? Do you know what your next
subject is? Yeah, I'm going to start a column for the San Francisco Chronicle, where I've been on leave, and I'll start writing a column for them in June. And then I'm going to give myself a breather from books, just because I think you need time off between books so you have something new to say.
How are you dividing your time and energy between trying to really take care of yourself and not push too hard, between that and the journalist impulse to keep pushing to meet that deadline, to keep driving yourself as hard as possible?
This is a matter of great discussion between myself and my lover and my friends, because I'm basically a workaholic. Coming from the Midwest, I think I have that Protestant work ethic, and I have a real hard time slowing down. And basically, I think I made the decision several years ago that, you know, I could just sit around and sip cappuccino and coffee shops here in San Francisco, and perhaps live longer. But I'd rather, you know, have the life that I have be meaningful, and I find my meaning in through my work. And so I'm probably going to keep on pushing.
This Sunday is a big gay march planned in Washington. What's the significance of that to you?
I think what's interesting is when I talk to people who are going, it's going to draw a much broader cross-section than any other gay march ever has. A lot of people who are never involved in politics are going to be at this march. And so I think it's meant to be a show of strength. And after the controversies around the military and then with the anti-gay campaigning that some of the Republicans did last year.
Well, Randy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Randy Schultz is the author of the new book, Conduct Unbecoming, Gays and Lesbians in the U.S. Military. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.